The 2004 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 364, Passivism, Priesthood, and Power, a paper presented by Dennis Clark with a response by Michael J. Stevens.
And with that, let me introduce briefly our speakers. Dennis Clark, who will be giving the primary paper here, is a librarian in Orem, Utah. He is a fine poet. He is the former poetry editor of Sunstone. And I just want to testify that years ago when I submitted a poem to him, I have a very vivid memory of standing across from him in his living room in Orem. He had me stand away from him so I would read the poem out loud so that we could both hear it and then decide how to revise it. Do you remember that? Yeah, it was fun. Our respondent, Michael J. Stevens, is a professor of management at University of Missouri, St. Louis, and a member of the Sunstone Board of Directors. He's also a former commissioned officer in the U.S. Marine Corps and a former assistant nursery leader. And with that, let me turn the time over to our speakers.
We're asked to leave time at the end of the session for audience questions. I will probably not leave as much time as necessary because with this audience, I'm sure that all the questions can be asked and answered in a shorter time. So I'm going to read pretty much everything I've written. In the spring of 1969, when I was 24 and had been married less than a year, I was called up for induction into the Army. I was just finishing a BA at Brigham Young University after serving a mission to Texas. I had returned from my mission convinced by 2 years of studying Scripture and teaching the Gospel that, as a holder of the priesthood, I could not participate in war. The previous spring, I had listened on a rented radio in Salzburg, Austria, to news of the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy. Hearing in language I barely understood, news I could hardly credit, had crystallized that opposition to violence, which had been focused by my study the previous year of the Doctrine and Covenants. I began thinking of the earlier assassination of another American religious and political radical, one I had been taught to call a martyrdom, in terms of priesthood, power, and persuasion. I found a personal basis in my reading of the 121st section of the Doctrine and Covenants for objection to war on grounds of conscience. My draft board rejected my beliefs on the grounds that the LDS Church was not a traditional peace church. Had the Army's doctors not rejected me because of my flat feet, I would have faced a choice between jail and exile. As it is, I have lived as an emotional exile within my church for 33 years, reflecting on the matter. Parley P. Pratt got it wrong. When I think of Joseph Smith in Liberty Jail, I just can't hear him declaiming, "Silence, ye fiends of the infernal pit! In the name of Jesus Christ, I rebuke you and command you to be still. I will not live another minute and hear such language. Cease such talk, or you or I die this instant." I can see him standing erect in the cell, manacled in chains. I can see the majesty in his bearing, the fire in his eye. I even think of Jesus driving money changers from the temple. But I don't hear what Parley recollects. Joseph was too good an orator to mistake his audience, as Parley has him do. But then I got it wrong, too. It's been wrong in my imagination, in my heart, for years, because I never bothered to read Parley's account. Joseph spoke that rebuke not in Liberty Jail, but in Richmond, Missouri, in late November, penned up in a cold, open, unfinished courthouse. He was held there during a court of inquiry, held for over 2 weeks with more than 50 other men, threatened nightly with death, mocked with reports of the pillage, rape, and murder of his people, mocked with the boasts of his guards, probably exaggerated to goad him and those imprisoned with him. Recent events in Iraq indicate how easy it is for trained, disciplined soldiers to yield to the temptation to bottom feed in matters of morality. Those guarding Joseph, Parley, and the rest were members of the militia that had fought the Mormons and expelled them from Missouri. At the end of the inquiry, Joseph was moved with Hiram and others to the jail in Liberty, Missouri, while Parley continued to be held in the jail at Richmond. Parley thus missed the genuine rebuke given at Liberty, one that has been far more significant to me. As a counterpart to that scene in Richmond, consider how Joseph died, not at Liberty, but at Carthage, shot to death in a gunfight at a jail, shot and killed as he appealed for help from his fellow Masons. Christians who don't believe that he was a prophet contend that this is not a martyr's death, that he went not as a lamb to the slaughter, but as a wolf. He did not embrace martyrdom, he fought against his death. By so choosing to meet death, did he resist evil? I was asked that question in Texas by a combative lay minister for the local Church of Christ. I had no real answer for him. Of course, he didn't want one. But he knew Christ's dictum. Ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, that ye resist not evil. But whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. Did Joseph turn the other cheek at Carthage? Is a Latter-day Saint obligated to do so? Or is that admonition directed specifically to the original 12 in Palestine, as some LDS commentators have argued? Though Joseph revised the section of Matthew from which this quote comes, he did not revise those two verses. It is worth noting in this context that he did revise Matthew 5:22 significantly. Restating the commandment, thou shalt not kill, Jesus says, as revised by Joseph Smith, ye have heard that it hath been said by them of old time, that thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment of God. But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother shall be in danger of his judgment, and whosoever shall say to his brother Raka or Rabcha shall be in danger of the council, and whosoever shall say to his brother, thou fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. Therefore, if ye shall come unto me, or shall desire to come unto me, or if thou bring thy gift to the altar, and there rememberest thy brother hath aught against thee, leave thou thy gift before the altar, and go thy way unto thy brother, and first be reconciled to thy brother, and then come and offer thy gift. What he revised there that you didn't hear going by is this clause, without a cause. What we hear in the King James Version is, but I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of his judgment, or in danger of the judgment. The way Joseph revised it, it takes out without a cause and says merely, but I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother shall be in danger of his judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, and so on and so forth. The revisions render this process of reconciliation much closer to that set forth in the jail at Liberty, Missouri. Based on these revisions, I would expect him to realize how easily a small injury escalates in the mind of the injured, and how strongly the disciple of Christ is urged not only not to kill, but not to bear anger towards his brother, let alone to bear arms. On the road to Carthage, Joseph is reported to have said two things that I find, in light of his subsequent actions, ironic. Meeting Captain Dunn with the company of Illinois militia, Joseph said, "Do not be alarmed, brethren, for they cannot do more to you than the enemies of the truth did to the ancient saints. They can only kill the body." After countersigning the order that Dunn was carrying from Governor Ford, requiring surrender of all the state arms in possession of the Nauvoo Legion, Joseph told his friends, "I am going like a lamb to the slaughter, but I am as calm as a summer's morning. I have a conscience void of offense toward God and toward all men. If they take my life, I shall die an innocent man, and my blood shall cry from the ground for vengeance, and it shall be said of me, 'He was murdered in cold blood.'" Mormons acknowledge as scripture three parts of a letter Joseph dictated while at liberty. The first of these, now the 121st section of the Doctrine and Covenants, gives the law of the priesthood and discusses the relation of that law to the exercise of power. The 122nd section is a personal comfort to Joseph, and the 123rd section an instruction from Joseph to the church. It is the 121st section that I turn for an understanding of power and priesthood. Time and again, especially when I find myself abusing my power as a father, I find there an admonition that will not let me rest at ease in the cloak of priesthood authority which I imagine myself to possess. There, the patriarchal order is defined. There are set boundaries to the rampage of my fallen and corrupt ego. There I find the clearest guide to my conduct as one holding the priesthood. There, the greatest comfort in my iniquity. That the prospect of being imprisoned in Carthage should daunt Joseph is not surprising. And if you haven't guessed by now, I'm going to be jumping back and forth between Liberty Jail and Carthage the whole paper through. So consider it a quick cut in a movie. Nor is it surprising that after the experience of his long imprisonment in Missouri, he should feel betrayed by the suggestion of some among his followers that his flight west to avoid Carthage jail arose from cowardice. The history of the church records that Emma Smith, through Porter Rockwell, urged her husband to return. Through a letter sent by Reynolds Cahoon, she also tried to persuade him to return. She even insisted that Cahoon should persuade Joseph to come back and give himself up. That's a quote. Cahoon apparently took Emma's mission with utmost gravity, for he, quote, "Lorenzo D. Wasson and Hiram Kimball accused Joseph of cowardice for wishing to leave the people, adding that their property would be destroyed and they left without house or home. Like the fable, when the wolves came, the shepherd ran from his flock and left the sheep to be devoured." To which Joseph replied, "If my life is of no value to my friends, it is of none to myself." The feeling of his followers that he was abandoning them was, as seems clear from this account, paralleled by Joseph's strong feeling that they were abandoning him, and perhaps not for the sake of the faith, but for the prosperity of Nauvoo. At liberty, Joseph had felt at least somewhat abandoned, writing to Emma in the letter that accompanied the other letter, "For my part, a word of consolation from any source is cordially received by me. I feel like Joseph in Egypt. Doth my friends yet live?" I believe that this feeling of abandonment led to the prayer that begins the 121st section. For those of you unfamiliar with the letter from which the 121st section is taken, it's a long, long letter. And the first excerpt from it comes in the middle, or close to the middle of the letter. Joseph sent it, as I said, under cover of the letter from Emma quoted above. It was published in his lifetime, and it was later excerpted into those three sections of Doctrine and Covenants. For the most part, however, I'm going to examine the content of the 121st section rather than its documentary history. The prayer begins in verse 1 with a straightforward rhetoric. O God, where art thou? And where is the pavilion that covereth thy hiding place? Sounds like it was cribbed from the Psalms. If it was, I can't find a direct source. But the language shares imagery with Psalm 18, in which David calls on the Lord to save him from his enemies with this as a reply from the Lord. Then the earth shook and trembled, the foundations also of the hills moved and were shaken, because he was wroth. There went up smoke out of his nostrils, and fire out of his mouth devoured. Coals were kindled by it. He bowed the heavens also and came down, and darkness was under his feet. He rode upon a cherub and did fly. Yea, he did fly upon the wings of the wind. He made darkness his secret place. His pavilion round about him were dark waters and thick clouds of the skies. At the brightness that was before him, his thick clouds passed, hailstones and coals of fire. The Lord also thundered in the heavens, and the highest gave his voice, hailstones and coals of fire. Joseph's prayer reads as if he expected such a result. The next two verses continue to build on the theme of the absent protector, on the wrongs and unlawful oppressions done the Mormons in Missouri, but in such tones that by the time verse 4 begins, the prayer begins to take on a little of that overstumped plumpness of Parley's remembrance. O Lord God Almighty, maker of heaven, earth, and seas, and of all things that in them are, and who controllest and subjectest the devil and the dark and benighted dominion of Sheol, stretch forth thy hand. Let thine eye pierce, let thy pavilion be taken up, let thy hiding place no longer be covered, let thine ear be inclined, let thine heart be softened, and thy bowels moved with compassion towards us. Let thine anger be kindled against our enemies, and in the fury of thine heart with thy sword avenge us of our wrongs. And finally, Joseph offers what sounds to me suspiciously like a bribe. Remember the suffering saints, O our God, and thy servants will rejoice in thy name forever. In this prayer for vengeance, Joseph pleads for an avenger in a tone not unbefitting the Old Testament. And like many of the prayers in those texts, this prayer is answered. But not with a vengeance. The answer, in fact, is a rebuke to Joseph. A rebuke as if in his role as a prophet he had just exercised unrighteous dominion. A term he would not use in this regard until the dictation of the second part of the letter sometime within the next 5 days. In response to an earlier version of this paper, Eugene England emphasized what I had only dared hint, that this call for vengeance was an instance of unrighteous dominion, and that the Lord used this time of great distress to teach Joseph the principle of priesthood rights under discussion here. It seems likely that it was Hiram who persuaded Joseph to return to Illinois and surrender in Carthage to stand trial for the attack on the expositor. History of the Church records that after being charged with cowardice, Joseph said to Porter Rockwell, "What shall I do?" Rockwell replied, "You are the oldest and ought to know best, and as you make your bed, I will lie with you." Joseph then turned to Hiram, who was talking to Cahoon, and said, "Brother Hiram, you are the oldest. What shall we do?" Hiram said, "Let us go back and give ourselves up and see the thing out." After studying for a few moments, Joseph said, "If you go back, I will go with you, but we shall be butchered." Hiram said, "No, no, let us go back and put our trust in God, and we shall not be harmed. The Lord is in it. If we live or have to die, we will be reconciled to our fate." Given the hint of self-pity in the statement which preceded this exchange, that is, if my life is of no value to my friends, it is of none to myself, Joseph's vacillation here is perfectly human. And in the face of his strong conviction that they would be killed as they returned, quite understandable. Hiram speaks here as one who has learned the lesson of the 121st section, but it seems that Joseph does not. Other revisions in the New Testament, which Joseph had dictated to Sidney Rigdon, strengthened significantly the teachings of Jesus on nonviolent response, as in these words from Luke chapter 6, verses 29 through 31. And I will read you with emphasis the words that are added. Unto him who smiteth thee on the one, on the cheek, offer also the other. Or in other words, it is better to offer the other than to revile again. And him who taketh away thy cloak, forbid not to take thy coat also. For it is better that thou suffer thine enemy to take these things than to contend with him. Verily I say unto you, your heavenly Father who seeth in secret shall bring that wicked one into judgment. Therefore, give to every man who asketh of thee, and of him who taketh away thy goods, ask them not again. And as ye would that men should do to you, do ye also to them likewise. The Lord's answer to Joseph's prayer for vengeance at Liberty Jail has three parts, occupying verses 7 to 25 of section 121. Each part addresses the faith of those involved. The first part, verses 7 to 10, is spoken as a comfort to Joseph himself and a rebuke to his lack of faith in God's justice, which is a theme that runs the entire answer. This is the Lord's answer. My son, peace be unto thy soul. Thine adversity and thine affliction shall be but a small moment, and then, if thou endure it well, God shall exalt thee on high. Thou shalt triumph over all thy foes. Thy friends do stand by thee, and they shall hail thee again with warm hearts and friendly hands. Thou art not yet as Job. Thy friends do not contend against thee, neither charge thee with transgression as they did Job. The Lord does not promise vengeance, but instead promises the feeling of triumph for one who succeeds in a difficult enterprise. Moreover, that promise is conditional on Joseph's enduring well the evils of the day. This is itself a rebuke. The phrase, peace be unto thy soul, serves both as a consolation and instruction. But when Joseph is compared to Job and found wanting, the rebuke takes an even stronger form. There is compassion in these words from the Lord, though not as strongly expressed as in the 122nd section, where the Lord also rebukes Joseph with the example of Christ and his suffering, he having descended below all the evil that Joseph could then imagine. On the evening of Thursday, 13 June 1844, in the midst of the furor over the destruction of the press of the Nauvoo Expositor, Joseph related to a meeting held in the 70s Hall a dream which I had a short time since. I thought I was out riding in my carriage, and my guardian angel was along with me. We went past the temple and had not gone much further before we espied two large snakes, so fast locked together that neither of them had any power. I inquired of my guide what I was to understand by that. He answered, those snakes represent Dr. Foster and Chauncey L. Higbee, two of the principals in the expositor. They are your enemies and desire to destroy you, but you see that they are so fast locked together they have no power themselves to hurt you. This image of his enemies locked in combat must have seemed ambiguous to Joseph, but hardly comforting. He had far too many enemies to be comforted by two fewer. In the second part of the rebuke the Lord spoke, verses 12 through 22, the Lord addresses the faithless saints, such as Chauncey Higbee, and talks about the comfort the Lord or Joseph can expect. And I'm skipping it right now. Joseph's dream in Nauvoo may have begun with the image of two snakes unable to strike at him, but things got worse. I then thought I was riding up Mulholland Street, but my guardian angel was not along with me. On arriving at the prairie, I was overtaken and seized by William and Wilson Law and others, saying, "Ah, ah, we have got you at last. We will secure you and put you in a safe place." And without any ceremony, dragged me out of my carriage, tied my hands behind me, and threw me in a deep, dry pit, where I remained in a perfectly helpless condition, and they went away. At this point, he has dreamt himself into the situation of that other Joseph who was sold into Egypt by his brothers. Whether, as he spoke, he recalled his letter to Emma of 5 years earlier, the one he sent as a cover letter to the church from Liberty Jail, cannot be known. But recall his question to Emma, "I feel like Joseph in Egypt. Doth my friends yet live?" And that, incidentally, is a direct quote from the letter. The grammar is Joseph's, as well as the handwriting. In the third and shortest part of the rebuke at Liberty Jail, verses 23 to 25, the Lord speaks of those outside the faith, all those that discomfort my people and drive and murder and testify against them. He has blundered to their fate and as to Joseph's request for vengeance. So the former, he says, a generation of vipers shall not escape the damnation of hell. Pretty generic. Of the latter, the Lord says, "Behold, mine eyes see and know all their works, and I have in reserve a swift judgment in the season thereof for them all. For there is a time appointed to every man according as his work shall be." The Lord reserves vengeance to himself in his own time, at his own discretion. Gently but firmly, he asserts his dominion, absolutely refusing Joseph any promise of retribution, holding forth judgment rather than the sword as his instrument of rebuke. I believe that this reassertion of divine justice could not have been far from Joseph's thoughts as he faced the decision to return to Nauvoo, a little cheap psychology there, and be taken to Carthage. Nor could the parallels between his situations at Nauvoo and Liberty. Joseph reported that the gathering in the 70s hall, or reported to that gathering in the 70s hall in his dream, "While struggling to get out, I heard Wilson Law screaming for help hard by. I managed to unloose myself so as to make a spring when I caught hold of some grass which grew at the edge of the pit." Notice that Joseph is still feeling capable of handling certain things himself. His athleticism had not deserted him. "I looked out of the pit and saw Wilson Law at a little distances, attacked by ferocious wild beasts, and heard him cry out, 'Oh, Brother Joseph, come and save me.' I replied, 'I cannot, for you have put me into this deep pit.' On looking out another way, I saw William Law with outstretched tongue, blue in the face, and the green poison forced out of his mouth, caused by the coiling of a large snake around his body. It had also grabbed him by the arm a little above the elbow, ready to devour him. He cried out in the intensity of his agony, 'Oh, Brother Joseph, come and save me or I die.' I also replied to him, 'I cannot, William. I would willingly, but you have tied me and put me into this pit, and I am powerless to help you or liberate myself. In the short time after, my guide came and said aloud, "Joseph, Joseph, what are you doing there?" I replied, "My enemies fell upon me, bound me, and threw me in." He then took me by the hand, drew me out of the pit, set me free, and we went away rejoicing. Given the circumstances of his arrest at Nauvoo, it would be hard to imagine him not recalling Liberty Jail and the feelings he had of having been abandoned there. It's no wonder that he had asked Porter and Hiram what he should do. Whatever his motives for leaving Nauvoo and traveling west, he felt strongly the danger he is in. You'd been there before. In the third section of the 123rd part of the 121st section, and again, this is a coherent or an extract from the letter, we see the Lord showing forth an increase of love after his rebuke to Joseph. And remember, this letter is dictated by Joseph to his scribes. All these words are coming out of Joseph's heart and mind. How long can rolling waters remain impure? What power shall stay the heavens? As well might man stretch forth his puny arm to stop the Missouri River in its decreed course or to turn it upstream as to hinder the Almighty from... And here it might not seem out of character for the revelation to read, avenging his scattered saints and those whose bones molder in the soil of Missouri. That would be what Joseph had asked for. What he wanted. But that's not how the text reads. It is not what the Lord offers. The Lord will not be hindered from pouring down knowledge from heaven upon the heads of the Latter-day Saints. No vengeance, just knowledge. That promise is important enough to my argument here that I don't want it to be obscured in the least by my attempts to emphasize it. Moreover, this verse, verse number 33, is a single excerpt from the letter. It's attached to the end of the preceding excerpt, but it stands alone in the letter. The two parts I've already discussed, verses 1 through 6 and verses 7 through 25, and the final part of the revelation, verses 34 through 47, are all coherent extracts from the letter, lifted without much more than corrected spelling and punctuation. The third part isn't. Verse 33 reads in its entirety, and I just read it to you, as vengeance was the focus of the first part and faith of the second, knowledge is the focus of the third part. Verses 26 through 33. But unlike the other parts of the 121st section, verses 26 to 33 are not a coherent extract. 32 is a different part of the letter from 33. They don't flow into each other. And the commentary that separates them reads as follows. But I beg leave to say unto you, brethren, that ignorance, superstition, and bigotry, placing itself where it ought not, is oftentimes in the way of the prosperity of this church, like the torrent of rain from the mountains that floods the most pure and crystal stream with mire and dirt and filthiness and obscures everything that was clear before, and all hurls along in one general deluge. But time weathers tide, and notwithstanding we are rolled in for the time being by the mire of the flood, the next surge, peradventure as time rolls on, may bring us to the fountain, clear as crystal and pure as snow, while all the filthiness, floodwood, and rubbish is left and purged out by the way. So not only do we have that commentary excised from the letter, verse 26 does not begin with a sentence. It begins in the middle of a sentence in the dictated letter. It's been edited significantly. It begins, let honesty and sobriety and candor and solemnity and virtue and pureness and meekness and simplicity crown our heads in every place, and in fine become as little children without malice, guile, or hypocrisy. And now, brethren, after your tribulations, if you do these things and exercise fervent prayer and faith in the sight of God always, he shall give unto you knowledge by his Holy Spirit. The text in the Doctrine and Covenants begins, verse 26, if you do these things, which is to say that in the letter Joseph sent to the church at Nauvoo, there was a rebuke to the church, and it was edited out. And the promise of that part of knowledge was conditional to the church. That promise was edited out. I'm only going to read one verse from that first part, the 26 through 32, that precedes verse 33, because it includes some part of that conditionality of the other promise. All thrones and dominions, principalities and powers shall be revealed and set forth upon all who have endured valiantly for the gospel of Jesus Christ. There is conditionality in that verse and nothing else in that long stretch, that promise of knowledge. We receive the blessing then as unconditional as regards the church. Is it possible that in Nauvoo Joseph had come to believe that the church and he had reached the next surge of the Lord's blessing? The original letter had stated, "The next surge peradventure as times roll on may bring us to the fountain as clear as crystal, as pure as snow," and so forth, "while all the filthiness, floodwood, and rubbish is left and purged out by the way." If he felt that the windows of heaven had been opened and a blessing poured out on the church at Nauvoo so great that they could not receive it, would he be inclined to tolerate more of the ignorance, superstition, and bigotry which he felt in liberty had mired the stream of God's revelation? If so, it seems to me he'd regard the expositor as floodwood. Or was he headed into the Rocky Mountains in search of that clear crystal fountain? No matter how unclear his motives in leaving Nauvoo, Joseph's actions at Carthage are clearly attested. He was jailed with Hiram, Willard Richards, and John Taylor. A mob surrounded the jail, burst in past the guards, rushed up the stairs, and broke open the door to the bedroom where the four were being held. Joseph had a six-shot revolver, Hiram a single-shot pistol. Just after firing his pistol, Hiram was shot through the door in the face and killed. Joseph shot around the door, three of his six barrels failing to fire. John Taylor and Willard Richards were beating down the firearms of the mobs with their canes from either side of the door when Taylor was hit and rolled under the bed. Joseph dropped his revolver, turned from the room, and sprang into the window when two balls pierced him from the door and one into his right breast from without, and he fell outward, crying, "Is there no help for the widow's son?" Willard Richards was not injured, although the lobe of his left ear was grazed by a ball. I don't call that an injury. At liberty, Joseph had faced the question of what leads a man to turn his back to the gospel and fight against the church. The largest part of the Lord's answer to his prayer for vengeance deals with those who do. That's back in verses 11 through 22. It makes sense, then, that when editing this letter for publication as a revelation, the editor should follow the imagery of knowledge pouring down upon the heads of the Latter-day Saints with an apparent non sequitur, beginning, "Behold, there are many called, but few are chosen," and ending, "Behold, ere he is aware, he is left unto himself, to kick against the pricks, to persecute the saints, and to fight against God." I apologize for summarizing. Pardon me, it ends, "Hence many are called, but few are chosen." That's verses 34 through 40, and it tells you why your priesthood goes. This excerpt is from the part of the letter that was dictated one or more days later. The letter was written over a period of 5 days, apparently at two sittings. One the first day, one 4 or 5 days later, a little hard to date. And this has some of the character of deliberation as well as the characteristic rush of imagery of the earlier part. It is as if Joseph, as a result of his contemplation of the previous part of the letter, is now ready to receive the law of priesthood. And in these verses, priesthood is equated with the powers of heaven, that same heaven from which knowledge will pour down. They give one condition only upon which the powers of heaven may be handled. That is righteousness. They offer two examples of unrighteous actions: hiding our sins and exercising unrighteous dominion. I believe that whatever else we may make of the patriarchal order, it is most clearly described in the next verses 41 through 46, and the breach of the proscriptions laid down there is most often flouted. These verses describe a burden laid on all who hold the priesthood, a burden grievous to be borne, and any man who refuses to govern his life in accordance with these verses faces the loss of any priesthood blessings he might ever have hoped to reach. You will be familiar with these. They begin, "No power or influence can or ought to be maintained by virtue of the priesthood. Only by persuasion, by long suffering, by gentleness and meekness, and by love unfeigned." And they end with the dominion flowing unto you forever without compulsory means. In light of those six verses, I find it hard to believe that a holder of the priesthood could be justified in using deadly force to persuade another or to reprove another. You can't show forth an increase of love to a corpse. I also find it a hard teaching that anything I might have to defend would justify the use of force, because the language is absolute. No power or influence can or ought to be maintained by virtue of the priesthood. It can be argued that if one were to defend his family with a gun, it would not be a defense by virtue of the priesthood. But in any situation I had allowed to come to such a pass, I believe there would be no virtue to my priesthood. As I read it, however, the injunction of that section is not against abuse of priesthood, which is covered in verses 34 to 40. I am enjoined toward power or influence being maintained only by persuasion, by long suffering, by gentleness and meekness, and by love unfeigned, by kindness and pure knowledge, which shall greatly enlarge the soul without hypocrisy and without guile. As one entrusted with the priesthood, I am urged to conduct my affairs with the same instruments Christ used, not with bullets or blades. Then to return to the question I was asked in Texas, did Joseph Smith in Carthage conduct himself as a disciple of Christ? I can't say. Joseph was a man. It is possible that he couldn't bear the burden placed on him by his circumstances, that he did not go as a lamb to the slaughter because, unlike Christ, he couldn't bear the blood and sins of his generation. But then again, he was not asked to. God provided our true high priest long before Carthage, long before Liberty Jail. He was one who prayed himself that the bitter cup of sacrifice be taken from his lips. It was not. And in his meekness, in his love unfeigned, in his pure knowledge, he drained the cup. You might ask me, do you believe that because he might not have been able to meet that standard, Joseph was a fallen prophet? No. No more so than any prophet. God has never required of the messenger that he bear the burden of the good news. Though logic might point to such a conclusion, faith rejects it. Joseph may be the protagonist in a tragedy of some significance. I don't know. That kind of graveyard psychologizing I've presented here is cheap because Joseph is beyond my reach. And thanks to God, I don't have to judge Joseph by what might seem his failure at the moment of his greatest stress. For God poured out upon his head in Liberty Jail the purest knowledge I have of what it means to handle the powers of heaven. He revealed the means of domesticating the strength which lurks in my wickedness, the power of rebellion.
And slaps you on the cheek, stand there with your feet apart so he can really hit you good. And then if he knocks you down, fall down and roll around on the ground in the fetal position, let him kick you a while more. That's not what he was saying, as I understand it. The question to aggression and how do you respond when others choose to use unrighteous dominion against you is not to trump them with greater unrighteous dominion by which you overpower them. The admonition from the Lord is to stop it right there and to find a better strategy, a response that makes genuine brotherhood or siblinghood, if you will, possible, which Dennis also points us to when he, in his paper, directs us back to especially the Joseph Smith revision of verses 21 through 24 of Matthew 5, which are the prelude to this, which interestingly enough point to the idea of creating brotherhood and giving gifts. Now, the passage mentioned in particular about leaving or reconciling yourself to your brother before you leave your gift. And I'd always read that and understood it to mean before you leave your gift at the altar. But one of the interesting things, I think, with most of the unrighteous dominion that takes place is that those who exercise the unrighteous dominion are trying to give a gift that the other person doesn't want. And so the question is, what do you do when, you know that you have a gift for the other person that they need, but they just won't get with the program? They will not see it your way. You may be motivated by love. You may, in some instances, be motivated like Joseph Smith was in Carthage jail to fight back and preserve your honor. But I would submit to you those are the exception. Most of the unrighteous dominion occurs when people in positions of power and influence choose to try to influence others by imposing their agenda. If they aren't interested, if they aren't receptive, if they aren't open to your agenda, what do you do? Well, you can forge ahead. You can impose your agenda, but that's what we call unrighteous dominion. Second alternative, you can break off, right? You can ignore, you can placate, you can turn away, try to avoid the problem, but that doesn't really resolve things either. In fact, that's more passivity. The only alternative, the third alternative, which I can see, is to work to spin up that other person's interest and receptivity. In other words, if you're going to give a gift and that other person doesn't want it, they just don't get it, they won't get with the problem, I would submit to you that you shouldn't give gifts that aren't wanted. What you need to do is try to understand why that other person has no interest in your gift. Usually has to do because there's no brotherhood. There is no siblinghood. There is no love. And there is no mutual respect. So how do you build siblinghood? How do you build mutual respect? How do you spin up the other person's interest and receptivity in what you're trying to give them rather than trying to force it on them? This is true whether you're talking about parents, whether you're talking about bosses, managers, peers, what have you. Well, DNC 121 gives us keys to that answer. You spin up the other person's interest and receptivity through persuasion, through long-suffering, gentleness, meekness, love unfeigned, pure knowledge, so on and so forth. There are actually specific skills you can also emphasize to master that, such as nowadays you can take classes, get degrees, learn how to use communication skills, listening, probing, things of that nature. There are skills and techniques that you can use. I would submit though that if you first work to change the heart so that I genuinely want brotherhood or sisterhood with another person, a lot of the details and mechanics will take care of themselves. Otherwise, I can become a master of interpersonal communication skills, which are merely a very gifted way of masking my real agenda. We call that Machiavellianism, right? I'm just going to learn how to be slick enough so that you don't realize how I'm manipulating you to get my own agenda. If these things can be done, what happens is we see a marvelous principle take place, and that is the principle of behavioral interaction. Those who don't come from a background in organizational may not have heard of this term. Essentially, it's a small little concept, that principle that tries to describe how you can successfully predict the way in which people will respond to each other as different influence tactics or strategies and different types of power are used to influence others. So if I'm trying to influence Kim, trying to get him to go along with my agenda, he can respond in one of three ways. He can respond with commitment, with love, as an active, self-generated person. He can comply or he may resist. All right. The method or strategy I use is very, very predictable. That is, if I use anything like unrighteous dominion on a really, really good day, if I'm lucky, Kim may respond with compliance. He may give me what I want. More likely than not, he will resent that, feel disrespected, and react with resistance, whether active or passive. And we see that kind of reaction all the time. There's only one way in which I can reliably predict or expect genuine love and commitment from another person, and that is when I follow the recommendation that we find in D&C 121. I'm going to take one more minute and wrap up. We'll take some questions. And that is, I want to share an example with you that I think is powerfully germane to our situation in the world today. Prior to Section 121, when Joseph Smith was still in Ohio, he'd gotten word of what was happening, going on in Missouri, and received a revelation in Section 98 there. The upshot of that was a conclusion wherein the Lord said, therefore, Joseph, what you and the people have to do is you have to renounce war and proclaim peace. Now, renounce is a strikingly powerful word. He didn't just say find something else, try different alternatives. The word renounce actually calls for or involves especially a renouncement by formal announcement. It has to be a proclamation. One of the synonyms is repudiate, right? To actively reject as a method or a strategy. Do we have any examples from the scriptures? Well, we're often told the Book of Mormon is a book written for us in our day. We always talk about the unremitting warfare and bloodshed in the Book of Mormon. In fact, one of the great heroes of the Book of Mormon, certainly primary kids, but most members in the church, do a word association. What do you associate with the name Ammon? Lopping off the arms, right? Actually, you know, that's a hard thing to get around, but in fact, Ammon and the other sons of Mosiah were there among the Lamanites in the first place because why? Mosiah 28, verse 2, that perhaps they might cure them of their hatred towards the Nephites. Okay? When they first came out with this proposal in Mosiah 28, how did the rest of the people in the land of Zarahemla react to him? You remember? After the third time, right? They had gone back three times and said, Dad, let us go. No, please, no. Really, we really want to go. And in fact, at the end of their... How long were they there, by the way? A little over a decade, right? They ran into each other on their way back, Alma 26, and Ammon starts rejoicing. Runs into his brothers, Alma 26, verse 23. He says to his brothers, you remember, my brethren, that we said unto our brethren in the land of Zarahemla, at the beginning of all this, we're going to go up to the land of Nephi to preach unto our brethren, the Lamanites. And what did they do? They laughed us to scorn. For they said unto us, do you suppose that you can bring the Al-Qaeda to... I'm sorry. the Lamanites to the knowledge of the truth? Do you suppose that you can convince the Lamanites of the incorrectness of the traditions of their fathers as stiff-necked a people as they are, whose hearts delight in the shedding of blood, whose days have been spent in the grossest iniquity, whose ways have been the ways of a transgressor from the beginning? Now, my brethren, you remember that this was their language? And moreover, did they say, no, let us take up arms against them, that we destroy them and their iniquity out of the land, lest they overrun us and destroy us. But behold, my brethren, we came into the wilderness not with the intent to destroy our brethren, but with the intent that perhaps we might save some few of their souls. How well did they do at that, by the way? They not only converted a couple of the minor kings, they converted the king over all the land, right? Okay. Lesson for our times, right? Why don't we go to Q&A? 1 minute. Comments, questions? 2 minutes. Well,
through our priesthood organization authority, we are instructed to support our country. And part of that is service in the military. What vehicle in your life have you felt has provided you with the instruction to do otherwise than that general instruction?
Okay, that question's for Dennis, right?
Well, specifically, the law that allows allows one to be exempted from military service on the basis of conscientious objection to war. That is also part of the law of the country. When I faced induction into the Army, as I said, I faced a choice. I could go to jail for refusing to be inducted, or I could leave this country, go to another country, become a citizen of another country. It never came to that because the Army wouldn't have me. But the law does allow for objection to military service on the basis of conscience. Even though my draft board wouldn't recognize the grounds for my refusal to serve. Provo. The question is asked, where was my draft board? It was in Provo. I don't think any draft board would have recognized it, however, because the Mormon Church is not a peace church, traditionally.
I was living in Whittier,
and mine did. Whittier, California, and yours did? Good. I'm glad to hear that. Question, does conscientious objection have to be based on a church belief? Not always. Typically, the draft board looks for that as evidence of sincerity, that you have a religious affiliation, and that that affiliation is with a church that is opposed to war, one of the peace churches, typically. But not always. It's an individual decision of the draft board, not a decision of the federal government. Do we have other questions?
What basis of Christian teachings in the Holy Scriptures, like the New Testament, what basis would that have played in your decision, or was it solely based on Latter-day Saint revelation?
My objection to war is based on those verses I read to you from the New Testament, as well as what I read in the Doctrine and Covenants. It was in the 121st section that I found a specific objection on the basis of my Mormonism. That was not the basis of my objection to war. That comes out of the New Testament and the teachings of Jesus Christ. Are there more questions? Karen would point out, and Will, that we're over time.
Well, yesterday when we went over time, Carol from Sunstone was at the back saying, this session is over, so we'll stop. And let me remind you, thank you for coming. Let me remind you that you can get tapes of this session in just a couple of hours. But let me also invite you to stay and talk with Dennis and continue the discussion. Oh, that's right. Yes. Well, I think Michael's pointing out that the after symposium party is at my house tonight. The directions are in the back of the program, and the discussion could continue there as well. So thank you all for coming.